So 1 Samuel 17 is our text today. And this is one of the most famous accounts in all of the Bible. It's the account of David and Goliath. I mean, it's an account that even just in our culture is synonymous with the underdog. You know, you think about David versus this giant Goliath. And so, you know, as we come to a text like this, you know, it's so familiar that sometimes we can kind of get lost in that, the familiarity. You know, we think about things we know about this text from previous times we've read it and things like that. And I just pray that today we won't be distracted in that way. I pray that we're able to kind of look at it with a fresh set of eyes and receive whatever God has for us today from this passage in 1 Samuel 17. So let's begin by looking at Israel's giant problem in 1 Samuel 17, verse 1. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah. And they camped between Soko and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley between them. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs, and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield carrier also walked before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, 'Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us.' Again the Philistine said, 'I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.' When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." And so we studied previously in 1 Samuel that war with the Philistines was a constant throughout Saul's reign as king. And so we're seeing that here again. This is another battle between Saul, you know, and the armies of Israel and the Philistines. And this one is taking place south of Jerusalem and west of Bethlehem at Soko and Azekah. And the armies there, as it said, are separated here by the geology. You know, there's one on one hill or mountain, one on the other, and there's this valley in between them. They're just kind of looking at each other across the valley there. And into this valley then, Goliath now descends. And you can only imagine that Goliath doing this was not really just fully of his own, you know, thinking, but probably his leadership thought, you know, hey, you know, why get all our guys potentially hurt and wounded and all that? We'll just send Goliath then as our representative. Nobody's going to beat him. And we'll send him down and see if Israel will take this challenge. Because Goliath, you know, is no weekend warrior, obviously, as we look at it. You know, he has the dress not only of a warrior, but it had to have been custom fit for him because he's this huge guy. You know, he has all these custom, you know, leggings and all this battle array has on. In fact, the man was said 6 cubits and a span tall, which, to put that in modern terms, would be 9 feet 9 inches tall. He's almost 10 feet tall. This guy was enormous. Even in that day, this was gigantic. This was not normal for someone to be that tall. And Goliath is actually thought to be of the line of Anakim. Back in Joshua chapter 11, the Anakim was a nation that was defeated by Israel during the conquest of Canaan as they came into the land. Except for some of the Anakim were not there together. There were some that survived in Gaza and Gath, which is where Goliath is from, and Ashdod. So some of them actually survived, and so we think that actually Goliath is of the line of Anakim. And so although his size sounds almost mythological to us, you know, to think of someone who's 9 foot 9 inches tall, there are actually other ancient accounts that describe men that were between 7 and 9 feet tall like this. There's an Egyptian letter on papyrus dated to the 13th century B.C., so that's an old letter, 13th century B.C., that describes Canaanites like this, that were like Goliath in their size. I mean, look at Goliath's armor alone. It describes the weight there. It uses shekels there. But when we put that weight into our terms, his armor weighed 125 pounds. I mean, it's like he's carrying, you know, another person on him, you know. That's really heavy. And his spearhead that it mentions there was 15 pounds. I mean, imagine trying to throw a spear that the head of it is 15 pounds. Have you ever thrown any kind of spear? If you've been spear fishing or anything like that, you know that, you know, the balance and all that's very important. If the tip was too heavy for you, it's just going to go right down. But he's so strong that a 15-pound tip, yeah, no problem. You know, I can throw this all day long. And so, obviously, just an enormous man. And it's no wonder in verse 11 there that Saul and all of Israel was dismayed and greatly afraid of this guy. I mean, who would want to go face him? And it wasn't just his size that scared him. He wasn't just this big guy, you know. He was he had the confidence of a seasoned warrior, you know. He's like, I know I can take any of you guys. Any of you, come on down. He's almost like you're expecting to say, two or three of you, come on down here, you know. I mean, he's like not scared at all. He was confident he could take them, and, well, the Israelites were confident he could take them too. You know, I mean, that's why they're not going down to face him. And so he puts himself out there with this open challenge, and he's just going to represent his nation. He's like, okay, send me your champion then, Israel, and let's just do this, you know, mano-a-mano, so to speak. And so Goliath here really, when you look at him, represented just an unbeatable problem for Israel. I mean, here he is, he's huge. I mean, first of all, he's loud, and he's not going anywhere. I mean, look at chapter 17, verse 16. It says he continued to do this for 40 days and nights. He just kept going out there for 40 days with this challenge. I mean, you can imagine, every day they're like hoping, maybe he won't do it today. No, there it comes again, you know, with this challenge. And just every day they're like, you know, wanting to dig the hole deeper and crawl into it. And Goliath is like a lot of problems in our lives today, I would suggest to you. Humanly speaking, we look at them and see that it's impossible. I can't possibly do whatever this thing is before me. And in that way, that problem sort of mocks at us, you know, and tortures us. It taunts us and wears us down, which is exactly what was happening to Israel. And it leaves us, like Israel was there, afraid and dismayed by this problem. But with that as a backdrop, let's see how God is going to handle this problem as he injects a hero here who is as full of faith in this scenario. Let's read from 1 Samuel 17:12. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the 2nd to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days, and took his stand. Then Jesse said to David his son, take now your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000 and look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And so we get reintroduced here to the family of Jesse. We've already been introduced. We're introduced again. The eldest 3 sons, which are named there again, as they were in the last chapter, are out serving Saul in war. They're in Saul's army. And David is serving Saul also, but he's kind of doing double time. We saw that last time. We didn't realize he was doing double work here, but he's still shepherding for his father. But also now he goes to Saul's home to minister to Saul. Remember, he has this ministry of music with the harp, that whenever Saul has this evil spirit come upon him, calls for David, and David comes in and plays the harp, and that soothes Saul and drives away this evil spirit, which we mentioned is not a normative thing, but it was something God did there through David. We're told here, though, more about Jesse, that Jesse's old. And so we can only foresee there that Jesse is basically too old to go check on his sons himself. And so he wants to send David to check on his sons. And he sends David with this food, you know, and it's kind of neat. He even sends like food for, you know, the commander of them. He sends this cheese for them. It's sort of like he's trying to bribe his way in there, make sure that it's okay that, you know, we come and check on things and then come back. I can't imagine he was really worried about his sons having enough food. I think he was just concerned about how are his sons doing. He wants to know that they're still alive and well, basically. And so he wants David to come back with the news. Let's read a little more from 1 Samuel 17:20. So David arose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines. And he spoke these same words, and David heard them. And so we're looking at David as this hero, who's this faith-filled hero, which is what we all want to be, is that faith-filled hero. And the first thing we see about David is he's obedient. As the hero here, he's obedient. Notice that, you know, his father asked him to go, and he goes. You know, he obeys his father here. David, I would suggest to you, was fit for great things of God because David was faithful with little things that God had for him to do. Little things like honoring and obeying your father. You know, one of the Ten Commandments. He obeyed that, and he did exactly what his father asked him to do. Sometimes believers find themselves frustrated that they're not getting great opportunities for ministry from the Lord. But God is watching to see what we do with those little opportunities that we have, those little chances he offers to us. Jesus told us in Luke 16, verse 10, that someone who is faithful in little things will be faithful in much. And the contrary is true as well. If we're not faithful in little things, we won't be faithful in more things. That's a paraphrase, but you can see that there in Luke 16, 10. Those little insignificant things that God offers to us as opportunities for us are actually God's proving ground for us. You know, a lot of times we're thinking, well, you know, I'm not really interested in that. I'm going to wait for the big thing. Now, when God brings me the big thing, then I'm in. But this little stuff, I'm not too into that. But God knows if we're not faithful in whatever those little things are that he brings to us, maybe it's, you know, having a conversation with a lost coworker, maybe it's whatever, he knows that, well, we're not going to do the bigger thing either. You know, we think we will, but he knows that we won't actually do it. And so he's waiting for us to learn faithfulness to him before he can entrust larger things to us. But David was faithful in a very little thing, of just obeying his father and going out here to find out what was going on with his brothers. And so now God has something much greater for him to do. Let's read from 1 Samuel 17, verse 24. When all the men of Israel saw the man, that's Goliath again, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. The men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" Then people answered him in accordance with this word, saying, thus it will be done for the man who kills him. Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle. But David said, what have I done now? Was it not just a question? Then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing. And the people answered the same thing as before. So the next thing we see about our faithful hero David here is he steps out in faith. That's what he's doing right now, is he's stepping out in faith. We're going to see that unfold more. But, you know, David hears Goliath, and he hears the same message that all the men of Israel are hearing, but has a completely different reaction, a completely opposite reaction to it than they did. They all reacted with fear. He reacts with faith. I mean, he's like, who is this uncircumcised Philistine talking about this? You know, I mean, you just feel his, you know, righteous indignation about this guy. But as David is going to step out in faith here, and he's going to do something about this problem, he encounters some hindrances to him stepping out in faith. And unfortunately, those hindrances are other people, is what happens to him. Now, there could be other hindrances to us stepping out in faith, but what he faces here are people. And sometimes this can happen to us too. As we step out in faith, we find hindrances that come in the form of other people. The first set of people I would suggest from this text are those who are criticizers. And, I mean, it's obvious who's criticizing him in this passage, right? It's Eliab's brother. Eliab overhears David, and David's just trying to get all the information here, and he judges his heart in verse 28. He basically is saying, well, you just came out here because you want to see some blood and guts. That's why you came out here. You came out here for the excitement of watching all of us fight, you know? And then he throws in a nice little put down in there about, what about those few sheep you're watching? You know, like your job is so insignificant. You got these three sheep or something out here you're watching. And it reminds us from what we studied last time of how David and his family was not seen as, like, you know, the golden child. And, you know, everyone thought, oh, obviously David, you know, this is king material here. They thought he was very insignificant. You know, they never gave him, you know, a thought as to being someone great. And yet God saw what was in his heart and knew he was going to be the greatest of all of them. And so, you know, in our lives too, sometimes we come across criticizers when we step out for God. When we step out to do something that the Lord is calling us to do, there can be those voices around us that are going to criticize us. Like Eliab, they generally jump to a wrong conclusion about us. They see that we're doing something, and they assume, you know, assign all these wrong motives to what we're doing, you know, of why we're doing it. And they think that they know more about you than they really do. They think they've somehow seen down into your heart, you know, and all they've seen is probably what's in their own heart, and they're projecting it on you. That's what often happens, is that their criticism reflects what's wrong with them, not what's wrong with you. I mean, maybe that would be your motivation in doing this. You know, maybe your motive would be incorrect, but that doesn't mean that mine is. You know, that doesn't mean that yours is. Our hearts can be pure and should be as we're led by the Lord in these things. Eliab, I think, here was clearly still smarting over the fact that David, insignificant David, got chosen as king over him. You know, Eliab was the first one rejected as king. You know, and he's like, what? I'm good looking. I'm tall. I'm big. You know, I should be the king, obviously. You know, to replace the big king we have now, you need another big guy. Well, that's not what God had in mind. And I think David shows really what turns out to be the best response to a criticizer like this in verse 30. I don't know if you caught that in verse 30. It just says that he turned away from him. I mean, basically, okay, I can't deal with this right now, you know. I'm not going to waste any time dealing with my brother. He's got a completely judgmental heart, you know. I mean, he's like way off, you know. I mean, it's not worth the time to deal with. There's a bigger thing at issue here, and that's God's will, and that's his problem that's facing God's people. God was moving on David's heart to act here. So he wasn't going to let Eliab discourage him or distract him. Because, you know, the enemy of our souls likes to do that. You know, when you're going to do something from the Lord, he'll send somebody that's going to distract you or discourage you away from what you're actually supposed to be doing. No, David's going to obey God in this big thing, just like he's obeyed God in the small things, like we've already talked about. And sometimes, you know, when we have those criticizers in our life, we have to do exactly what David did here. It's not like we're trying to be rude to somebody. We're not going to, you know, be mean to somebody, something like that. But we need to be clear, you know, I don't agree with you, and, you know, we're just going to have to agree to disagree, you know, and then just go about our way. Because there's always going to be a criticizer out there somewhere, and we can't let the criticizers of this world paralyze us and paralyze our obedience to the Lord, you know, because that's what they're going to do. They're being used by the enemy. Now, they may be a Christian, don't get me wrong. They may be a believer that's just in the flesh or whatever, but they're also maybe being used by the enemy to try and thwart God's will, you know, and God's plan. So we can't allow ourselves to get sucked into that vacuum. But that's just the first hindrance that David encountered. The next hindrance are a set of people that I will call the misguided. Let's read from 1 Samuel 17:31. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." Then Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth." And so this group of those who are kind of misguided, I would say, generally have the right heart in this situation. They have the right heart towards you as a person, but they're lacking in faith. In response to David's pronouncement of faith, "Hey, I'm going to take care of this whole problem, King, don't worry about it," Saul is concerned. And he's concerned for the safety of David. I don't see any selfishness in Saul here. I don't think Saul's thinking, yeah, if he gets defeated, the whole nation collapses. They're not going to go with Goliath's plan. You know, yeah, we're just going to send a guy out, and now we're going to submit to you guys. I mean, they got their whole army there. There's going to be a fight between the armies eventually. But I think he's just concerned. You know, David, you know, you're a boy. This guy's a man. You're going to go out there, and you're going to get killed is what's going to happen. And so he has that genuine concern for David, but there's also no faith there. He has no faith in David. He has no faith, really, that maybe God is actually doing this thing. And this is what can happen in our lives. We can find someone around us who are a little bit misguided, you know, in their counsel. They have a heart of compassion for you or for me, but maybe they just don't have the eyes of faith to see that God's doing something here that's a little different than they expected. And if you've ever stepped out in faith, especially in something that seemed a little bit, you know, crazy to people, you know what I'm talking about. You know, I remember when I was getting ready to move to Texas, and, you know, there were definitely people in my family that thought I was, you know, crazy, you know, and worried about what's going to happen to me, moving out there all by yourself, you know, and stuff and such. And I was in my 20s, so I wasn't, you know, as old as I am now, so a little more concerned, you know, especially my parents. But God had a plan, and I knew it was God's will. And so I followed it, even though I didn't know what was going to happen on the other end, you know, and that's just moving across America. There's people doing so much greater things than that, going on to missions into dangerous places and such. But, you know, when it's God's will, we've got to go. We can't stay there in the place of safety, because it ultimately is disobedience. Well, the final set of hinderers in this passage are the advisors that come into our lives sometimes. Let's read from 1 Samuel 17, verse 34. It says, "But David said to Saul, 'Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God.' And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." Then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." And David took them off. So David, you know, shares here from his resume, if you will, his work experience as a warrior. Okay, I haven't fought any men, but I have taken down a lion and a bear. I was like, wow. I think I'd much rather face another person than a lion and a bear. They got big teeth. So, I mean, you see this graphic description he has, too. I mean, of grabbing a lion by the beard, you know. I mean, just a few weeks ago, there was a circus in the area here in Central Texas, and my family went to it. And part of it was, you know, they didn't have lions, but they had the whole tiger pin, you know, where the man's having the tigers do various things. And you see the size of those things, you know, and like their head is like, they could put your head in their mouth, you know. You're like, wow, I'm going to grab that thing by the beard, you know. No way, I'm not going to get anywhere close to that thing. And so, I mean, David has, he's got some good experience, I think it's safe to say here. And so he's telling Saul, he's like, look, you know, with the Lord's help, I got this, right? I mean, God has spared me from a lion and a bear. He can take care of this guy. You know, I'm confident that the Lord can do it. And so David had real reasons to believe here, even. God had prepared him for this moment by these previous victories in his life. And Saul appears to be moved by this. Either he's moved by it and says, yeah, this kid's got real potential. Or he just realizes, well, I can't stop him anyway, so I guess I'm going to equip him here. You know, he's going to suit him up in his armor, his own armor for David. Now, this is not to say that we should never take advice. When I talk about these advisors being a hindrance to ministry, so don't read that the wrong way. Because the Bible does tell us that there is victory in many counselors. We see that in Proverbs chapter 11, verse 14. And so it is wise to receive advice. I mean, the Proverbs even tells us that the wise become wiser because they do listen to wise people. And so we definitely want to do that. We don't want to just be arrogant about our opinion, think our opinion is always right. We want to listen to other people. But this makes clear to us that not all advisors are created equal. You know, they're not all created equal, and they're not all their advice, even from a godly person, not all their advice is 100% necessarily going to be from God in the end. Because Saul has advice here. You know, Saul is the king. He's the leader of Israel. Of course, which means he's not very spiritual. We know that. But his advice is not from the Lord. You know, that's not where it's coming from. He can only perceive of David fighting the way that he would fight. You know, if Saul, I'm a seasoned warrior myself. If I was going to fight this guy, I'd put my armor on. You know, obviously, I need my gear here to go face this guy. And so he tries to dress David up like himself. But God wasn't going to work through David the way he had worked through Saul. I mean, God had worked through Saul. I mean, they'd won many battles. But this is also true in our lives, too. You know, that just because God's worked some way in someone else's life isn't necessarily how he's going to work in and through your life. There are others who want to help us, and, you know, they have the right heart in that. But sometimes we, you know, think as people that God always works in the way that I've seen him work in my life. And so we think that everyone's ministry needs to look like everyone else's ministry. You know, it needs to be the same way. Well, not so much. And it could be that that person's had a lot of success who's trying to advise me. So they you know, from a right heart, they think, this is what works. You know, this will really help you accomplish what you need to accomplish. But it may not be. You know, God can work in different ways. We see that when we look in the Gospels. We see all the different ways that Jesus healed people. Very creative ways that Jesus healed people of some of the same ailments, but didn't always use the same methodology. And so we see that God is not cut, he's not set in one prescription. There's not one way that he always works. And I mean, even churches, whole churches sometimes fall into this mistake. You know, they see, you know, the mega church out there, and they see how it grew so fast and all these things that happen. And they think, well, I just need to read the book, you know, by this mega church pastor or go to their conference or whatever. And if I did, we just do everything the way they did at their church, kaboom, you know, it's just like putting it in a microwave, pow, you know, you put the popcorn in there and, you know, 2 minutes later, you got a whole bag of popcorn, you know, I mean, just think that's what's going to happen. But you know, that's not really how God works. Instead, what we need to do is we need to find what God's will is for our church and for our ministry and for our lives, and we need to follow that. And when you talk about a church, clearly the essentials of Bible teaching and fellowship and communion, all those, you know, core aspects of a church are going to be there. But beyond that, God may have all kinds of plans that are unique to that particular church that he doesn't have for some other church. Well, finally then, as we're looking at this faith-filled hero in David, we're going to see the victory that David experiences. Let's read from 1 Samuel 17, verse 40. It says, speaking of David, he took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Then the Philistine came on and approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. The Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and the gates of Ekron. And the slain of Philistines lay along the way to Shaaraim, even to Gath and Ekron. The sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapons in his tent. And so we have two very different champions here, coming from two different worlds, if you will. We have Goliath, who really is of the world. You know, he's not a believer. He's, you know, a worshiper of pagan gods, we saw. And, you know, he's there, and he's approaching this battle with David. He's mocking at David. He's like, "I've been waiting 40 days, and you send out this runt? You know, that's what you got? Where's the sword? He's got a stick. I mean, what is this?" And so he's cursing David in the name of his pagan gods. He's taunting the living God, ultimately, is what David says. And his speech there is just full of pride, you know. He's like, "I'm just going to whack your head off, and that's going to be it. You know, I mean, I got this, no problem." But then there's David. He comes from a completely different world, as it were. He's a godly, you know, man, or godly young man. And he has this righteous indignation, you know, about everything that Goliath has been saying, how offensive it is to God, of how Goliath's been carrying on. He's actually kind of warning Goliath, really. He's like, "No, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to chop your head off, and we're going to kill all your army then too." And I mean, basically warning him and prophesying, really, the victory that God is going to give. And his speech there is just full of faith and clearly giving glory to God. of what's going to happen. It's the Lord who's going to do this. He's confident. And I want to suggest to you that there are still enemies of God today. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. And those enemies of God still act like Goliath. A lot of times in our lives, we see this. I mean, Christians are routinely mocked today in the media and elsewhere. Our God is blasphemed, even in the most casual conversation. You know, you hear people talking that aren't believers, and the way they use the Lord's name and such, or make fun of, you know, things about God and about the Bible, it's flabbergasting, I guess, to for lack of a better word. And people proudly think that they know better than those of us who are Christians. They're leaning on their false gods like science and pleasure and wealth. But their gods are really no match for the living God. Just like Goliath's pagan gods were no match for God, these false gods today are no match for the real God. And look at the differing weapons of these two champions. I mean, here's Goliath. Goliath has what you'd expect. I mean, he has a sword, he has a spear, he has armor, all these things. He's got a guy carrying a shield for him, which would have been one of those large shields that they could kind of hide their body under. So he had a guy carrying that shield for him. David has what appears to be nothing. He's got like a little stick, you know. He's got a sling, and he's got his faith in God. That's all he's got. Now, in verse 40, it talks there about David grabs, you know, five stones there from the brook. And there's been a lot of speculation as to why he grabbed five stones. There's some colorful stories around why he grabbed five stones. We don't really know why he grabbed five stones. It doesn't say. He just grabbed five stones. And maybe that's what he'd normally put in that pouch. Maybe that's what would fit, you know, in the pouch. And so that's why he grabbed five stones. But I don't think it diminishes David's faith any that he grabbed five stones versus one stone. Whether he needed to hit Goliath one time with a stone or five times, facing that guy with a sling when he's got all these weapons and all this, you know, armor on and all that, that takes a lot of faith, you know, to face this guy. In the same way today, as believers, in the spiritual battles in our lives, we fight with different weapons. In our world today, most people fight with their words. I mean, thankfully, we're glad for that. You know, that there aren't people walking around with swords and stuff like that in the street. Most people fight with their words. And those who are not of God, the lost in the world, they're willing to aim low with those words. They're willing to be quite mean and demeaning with their words. And we see that a lot, especially in the era of social media. Some of the posts and things that go around is the vileness of how people attack other people and things. But as Christians, you know, we maintain a witness in our words, right? I mean, even if we are in a debate with someone who is not giving us respect, we give them respect as a creation of God. They were created by God in His image. Now, they're not walking with God. They don't know God. They're not following Him. But we give them respect because of that, you know, and because actually we don't really see them as an enemy. We love them. We want to see them get saved is what we want to see happen. And we actually do our best fighting in prayer. That's where our best fighting comes from as believers. Just like David was trusting God to guide that stone, you know, to hit the man in the forehead. I mean, what a shot, you know, to hit. That's like the smallest place you can picture hitting somebody. It's also a place that was vulnerable with his armor. In the same way, though, we look to God to take down those giants in our lives. You know, if we're in a debate with somebody or some sort of disagreement with somebody, especially someone who's outside of the faith, you know, we're praying. We're asking God to work on the inside, you know, and whittle that down and change this person's heart to what it should be. We're asking Him ultimately and sometimes to even defeat those who make themselves our enemies. We don't see them as enemies, but when they make themselves our enemies, we ask the Lord to defeat them. And really, we ask the Lord to provide for us every day those things we need. We ask Him for provision just to walk as believers. You know, and that alone takes God's power in our lives, that we have a life that looks anything like it's supposed to. But our weapons, in the end, are not physical weapons, they're spiritual weapons. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 4 says this. 2 Corinthians 10, 4 says, "The weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. And, you know, in our story today, our account from the Old Testament, we see that David is victorious. Goliath falls after a single blow to the forehead. And David then, as he prophesied, takes his head off. And he even keeps his weapons then as booty there. In verse 54, it's kind of interesting. And we're going to see, you know, those weapons come up later on in 1 Samuel 2. Don't you kind of love that, you know, David, that Goliath's armor bearer is just like totally gone in this scene? I mean, you know, how loyal was he to Goliath? You know, this guy, you know, David knocks down Goliath and comes over there, casually takes his sword. I mean, where's the guy that had his shield? Or where's he's going to defend him? No, he's gone. You know, he's out of there. It's like, this kid's crazy. I'm gone. This all also reminds us of Jonathan's victory in chapter 14. Remember how Jonathan had this great victory with his armor bearer? And after that happened, it sent the enemy into a panic. I mean, the Lord really sent them into a panic. Well, the Lord does the same thing here. The Philistines now are freaking out. And as a result of what David did, all Israel experiences this great victory here on that day. Our text says that they pursued the Philistines all the way to Ekron. And so Ekron is about 25 miles west of Jerusalem. So it wouldn't have been the whole 25 miles because they were west of Jerusalem too. We don't know exactly how far west. But clearly they went for miles chasing them and slaughtering them the whole way. I mean, that's what the text is intending to help us see. As a result of David's faithfulness there and his victory then, David now is going to be honored as this man of faith that he is. Let's read from 1 Samuel 17:55. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" And Abner said, "By your life, O king, I do not know." The king said, "You inquire whose son the youth is." So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul, with the Philistine's head in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." And so it's a little bit gory to us to think about him carrying his head around as a trophy, but I guess he wanted to present it to the king. But look, got him, you know, in case you missed it out there in the field. I got him. Here it is. And when all this is going on, though, you know, Saul asks about David. You know, he's asking his commander there more details about David. Now, it's clear that Saul knew who David was. And so this kind of confuses people. Why is he asking about David when he already should know David? I mean, David's the one who comes and plays the harp for him. You know, our chapters even talked about that. So Saul knew who David was. But Saul didn't remember whose family David came from. And that's what we really see in this passage, is he's confused about whose family is David of. And that was for an important reason that he asked this, because back in verse 25, he said that the household, the family of whoever this victor is, well, they're going to be exempt from taxes. And so he needed to know who David's dad was. And so he knew David, but he didn't remember who David's father was. And so now David stands there before the king, the head of the feared foe in his hand, again, kind of gross there, and he's victorious. And from this point forward, Saul is not going to have any question about who David is, who his line is from, and all that, because if you look at chapter 18, verse 2, it says there that Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. So he basically says, okay, no, you're not going to be doing double duty anymore. This whole shepherding gig is over. You know, Jesse, you can take care of that yourself. I'm taking care of your taxes so you can hire somebody to do this now. You know, and David's going to stay with me at my house. And so, again, this is such an incredible account of David and Goliath. And as we study it today, or as we have studied it, the question that comes to my mind is, what battles are we facing today? What battle are you in today in your life? Is there some problem that you're facing that has you scared and has maybe your loved ones scared? Are you dealing with some person who doesn't fight fair? I mean, all these things are possible, and so many others. But I just want to exhort us all to remember that God is still here. God is still here today. Just as he stood with David before Goliath, he's available to you, he's available to me, if we will stand with him. I mean, never forget that it wasn't David that defeated Goliath that day. David would be the first to say, it was God that defeated Goliath that day. All David did was believe that God could do it, and then allow God to work through him. And so God's available to us in the same way. And so we shouldn't go it alone. We don't want to be, you know, battling in this life with just our flesh and blood, you know, using our own resources. We need to involve God in our problems and make use of the spiritual weapons that are available to us as believers. The scriptures tell us that we should renew our minds. You know, we should renew our minds with the Word. We should be getting God's Word into our minds so that we're thinking in the way that we should about our problems. In Philippians 4, verse 8, it tells us, among other things, to let our thoughts dwell on what is true. And so often I find that we let our thoughts dwell on what's not true. When we're thinking about our fears and we're thinking about, you know, the lies that other people might be telling us, instead of thinking about what's true in this situation, what would God say about this situation? And then, as we said before, that we do the real battle in this life, we do it in prayer. That's where the real battle takes place, is in prayer. Because God is still able to take down giants. I know we all believe that. God is still able to take down giants. So let's let him have the giants in our lives. Let's close with prayer. Lord God, we are so thankful that you care about us and that you see the problems that come our way and those giants in our lives, Lord, that terrify us. And God, help us to just get you into the picture and allow you to defeat those giants, Lord. Help us to see you as the one who's going to solve the problem and not lean on ourselves, but lean on you. And Lord, we just believe you today that you will take down those giants in our lives and you will give us victory. Sometimes that victory looks different than we think, but we trust in you for that victory all the same and for your just sovereign purposes in our lives. We'll give you all the glory for what you do. In Jesus' name.